From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland.
Hello from South Berkeley, below Ashby.
I live in North Richmond.
Kentfield.
Oh, I live in San Jose, near Campbell.
Bayview.
Coming up, after the shooting of Mario Woods, a look into San Francisco's efforts to repair the public's trust in its police department.
And what I heard in here tonight, they not about to do nothing.
Then a new federal policy threatens San Francisco's sanctuary city status, and a public defender says it's misguided.
It's bluster, it's symbolic.
And Bay Area Korean Americans use an ancient tradition to forge new identities.
There's not a definition of being Korean, that's for you to define for yourself.
Something old and something new, today on Cross Currents. Right now, two separate investigations are trying to determine whether the San Francisco Police Department has a problem with racial bias. The U.S. Department of Justice began to review the SFPD after police shot and killed Black Bayview resident Mario Woods in December. And last year, District Attorney George Gascon asked an independent panel to take a look at the department after officers were caught having exchanged what many called racist, sexist, and homophobic text messages. That same panel is reviewing thousands of documents and holding a series of public hearings to gather testimony from officials and to get input from the public on how they view the police. It's just one step in an effort to restore public trust in the police. KALW's Jeremy Dalmas went to one of those hearings. He brought back this story.
As soon as I walk into the basement of the San Francisco Main Library, I can tell that community police relations aren't great right now.
Act up! Fight back! Fight Gascon's corruption! This panel is BS!
The third meeting of the Blue Ribbon Panel on Transparency, Accountability, and Fairness in Law Enforcement hasn't even started yet. About 50 members of the public, the media, and city officials are here. Up on stage sit three judges who've come in from across Northern California. Anand Subramanian, executive director of the panel, starts things off.
The panel is tasked with evaluating the San Francisco Police Department's policies and practices for institutionalized bias. In addition to the judges reviewing thousands of incident reports that were compiled by the officers involved in the texting scandal, eight law firms are supporting the panel on a pro bono basis to look at the following issues: stop searches and arrests, personnel and internal discipline.
The judges are here to interview witnesses on stage about whether or not the culture of the police department is fundamentally racist and what can be done about it. And they're doing this because of text messages, racist text messages. They were discovered between 14 police officers on their personal phones. I'm going to read one example, and let me warn you, it's hard to hear. In reference to a Black man coming over for dinner, one officer wrote to another, quote, "Get your pocket gun. Keep it available in case the monkey returns to his roots. It's not against the law to put an animal down," unquote.
Today's hearing will be focused on an examination of four high-level city officials.
On the stand will be District Attorney George Gascon, the Director of City Audits, the President of the Police Commission, and right now, Police Chief Greg Sir. As he walks up, one audience member yells at him, "Fire Chief Sir."
Fire Chief Sir!
Some hold up signs for the entire hour he's on stage that say, "Jail Killer Cops" and "Stop Police Terror." Many are here from Justice for Mario Woods Coalition. Jerry Roth is the lawyer helping the judges question the chief. He tries to suss out if there's a climate in the department where racism would thrive.
Is there a problem at the San Francisco Police Department, from your perspective as the chief, with respect to there being, let's call it an old boys network, or there being cliques that where there are some people who are on the in and some people who are on the outside?
Within every profession, there is a culture, and within every profession, there are those that feel that they're more in than out, and the police department's no different.
He's not answering the question.
Sir insists throughout his testimony that the police department is doing everything in its power to increase diversity in hiring.
And I have been very loud and clear on this. There is no place for a dishonest cop or a racist police officer, and I intend to expel both as quickly as I can.
But one judge on the panel, Judge Ladarius Cordell, questions whether the offending officers will be disciplined at all. The text messages were sent in 2011, the same year that Chief Sir got his job. The Internal Affairs Department found out about the text messages in December of 2012, but the public didn't know about them until March of 2015. Cordell says the department may have sat for too long without taking action.
Once a police department is aware of or has notice of alleged misconduct, then the clock starts ticking. And if an officer is not given notice that he or she will be disciplined within 1 year, then no matter how egregious the behavior, the officer cannot be disciplined.
Cordell also suggests that the SFPD has been purposefully getting in the way of the investigation.
There has been basically obstruction, delay, in trying to get information from the department that these lawyers would like to get to be able to present to us and to the public. And so that's a real concern.
For example, at the last hearing, a black officer who was specifically targeted in some of the racist text messages testified that she saw pervasive racism in the department. Later, the president of the city's police union published a letter to her stating, quote, "I find your testimony to the panel to be largely self-centered and grossly unfair to the almost 2,200 officers of this department," unquote. After more testimony from officials, it's finally time for the public to speak. People start lining up in the aisle, but there are only 10 minutes left for public comment. Felicia Jones from Justice for Mario Woods Coalition steps up.
"We want Chief Sir fired."
Jones says she's tired of coming to meetings that spend hours talking with city officials and only minutes listening to the public.
"We need a better process to be fair to us, a community that is hurting, a community that is in pain, and no one seems to understand that."
This hearing is supposed to be one step in the healing of community police relations, but the very process is part of the problem to Jones and her coalition. Then she and others from her group storm out in frustration.
"Come on, let's go, y'all.
Stop the genocide of black and brown people. Stop killing our youth."
They gather in the hallway to debrief with each other. Frank Williams explained that every time they go to hearings like these, he feels the organizers consistently cut down on the time for public comment.
"We have some information that we can give to this Blue Ribbon Commission that we could tell them from us, from being in the community."
Williams says that in addition to firing Chief Sir, they want to see the officers who killed Mario Woods brought up on murder charges. If they don't get the chance to voice these demands, he doesn't have a lot of hope that the department will change.
"They're not about to do nothing."
The director of the panel says that he will reach out to the coalition to figure out how best to have more public input at the next hearing. The panel will produce a report this spring with its findings and with policy recommendations. But even the district attorney admitted today that altering the culture of a police department can take 5 or 10 years. So if change is coming to the San Francisco Police Department, it likely won't take root this year or even this decade. In San Francisco, I'm Jeremy Dalmas for Cross Currents.
The next hearing for the Blue Ribbon Panel hasn't been scheduled yet, but tomorrow evening, the U.S. Department of Justice will host a community listening session as part of their investigation into the SFPD. It'll be at the Mission High School Auditorium starting at 6 p.m. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. On July 1st last year, Kate Steinle was shot and killed. An undocumented man, Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez, is currently on trial for her murder. The shooting spurred anti-immigrant groups nationwide who rallied to end sanctuary city policies. These are policies that limit how much city employees may help immigration and customs enforcement. Critics say they protect undocumented people from being handed over to immigration authorities, even when they commit a crime. San Francisco adopted these policies in 1989, designating itself a city of refuge. Today, that status is in danger. A new policy by the federal government would force cities to cooperate with immigration authorities in such cases. Francisco Ugarte is an immigration attorney at the San Francisco Public Defender's Office and is defending Lopez Sanchez. He came by to talk about the real effect the new federal policy will have on the city.
Well, there's been a lot of reports about this new policy, but I don't see this new policy really changing anything on the ground. I've been an attorney for around 10 years, and I can remember one incident where someone serving a federal sentence who was undocumented was not transferred immediately to deportation, and that is the case of Mr. Lopez Sanchez. I've literally never seen a case where somebody who completed their federal sentence not get turned over to immigration. The narrative around immigration and what happened on July 1st, those two things are different. We don't see any relevance between sanctuary and what happened on that day. Yet that's what everybody's talking about. That's what the right wing is talking about. Well, there was a study recently from the University of Chicago and New York University where two law professors studied the Secure Communities program. Secure Communities was a federal program that's now disbanded that required local law enforcement to engage in civil immigration enforcement. Following a study of several years of the implementation of that program, there was no correlation between public safety and immigration enforcement. There is no studies to suggest that collusion between the two, between local law enforcement and immigration enforcement, actually promotes public safety. Mm-hmm. So this narrative that is being restated over and over again in the right-wing media by Republican presidential candidates is actually incorrect. There is no correlation between public safety and immigration enforcement.
This policy has been in place since 1989. Has it been challenged that much? I mean, if it was this big of a problem, why has it not been challenged in a major way since then?
Well, I think, yes, there have been issues around sanctuary policies and protests here and there. I think the reason why it's so heightened today is because we live in a society of mass deportation. We have never in our country's history, seen such entrenched collusion between immigration enforcement and local law enforcement. When designing a program for mass deportation, it would be inefficient to rely merely on federal officers because federal officers wouldn't have the capacity to engage in mass deportation. You have to look at other institutions in society to hope that they cooperate with immigration. And in the last 10 years, we've seen the number of deportations dramatically, exponentially increase. Mm-hmm. From 1996, there were around 50,000 deportations a year. 2001, there were around 120,000 a year. 2013, the height of Secure Communities, there were 438,000 deportations a year, the vast majority of which were a direct result of a contact with local law enforcement. So I think myself, I'm a deportation defense attorney. I've had many clients, survivors of domestic violence, that were involved in a domestic dispute, initially arrested for being the dominant aggressor in a domestic dispute. But after the police sorted it out, turned out that the person who was originally accused of a crime was actually the survivor of domestic violence. Yet, due to misplaced, misguided immigration policies, the survivor was transferred to immigration for deportation, the result of that person, her, calling the police for help. Those situations replicated over and over again.
You see that?
I've had five clients in San Francisco alone as a single deportation defense attorney. If you Google domestic violence survivors deportation, you'll see cases over and over again. In San Francisco, we saw people who were charged but never convicted of a crime being transferred to immigration. And these people, you know, 40% of undocumented adults have a U.S. citizen child. So we're seeing families get separated on a wide, wide scale.
So you said this is really not going to affect you a whole lot in your work. Can you explain that further?
Sanctuary policies exist in virtually every urban area in the United States. That's because law enforcement recognizes that in order to promote public safety, they can't collude with immigration enforcement because immigrants will not want to report crimes. I mean, chiefs of police in their associations say sanctuary policies support public safety. So at some point, this anti-immigrant political narrative runs into the truth and runs into policymakers that say, well, these sanctuary policies will actually hurt public safety instead of help.
So do you feel then that this move by the administration is largely symbolic?
Yes. It's bluster. It's symbolic. It's designed to tell the public, or maybe even tell these Republican Congress folks, that
it's okay.
We're doing something about Lopez Sanchez. You know, that's what this policy seems.
You think it really boils down to Lopez Sanchez?
I think that, unfortunately, the case of Mr. Lopez Sanchez has become a bellwether or a symbolic to a struggle around sanctuary cities and immigration enforcement. And you mentioned Mr. Lopez Sanchez, you mentioned Ms. Steinle, and the anti-immigrants become very loud, very aggressive, and they say things like San Francisco should be charged with the crime. You know, San Francisco is responsible for the death of Ms. Steinle. And that's just not the case. And like I said before, originally this case was reported as if it was an intentional homicide. That's not the case. This was a single shot ricochet off of the pier. And we've never seen a single shot ricochet charged as a murder in San Francisco. If the alleged, if the person who, you know, if Mr. Lopez Sanchez was a white college student visiting San Francisco and accidentally discharged a weapon, it's debatable as to whether he would ever have been charged with the crime.
San Francisco, the city of refuge since 1989, is that image being tarnished? And, you know, has this case and all this talk about sanctuary city and this new policy, what does that do to the city?
I think people in San Francisco are pretty sophisticated on this issue. And the Board of Supervisors just debated a resolution that would have rolled back sanctuary policies in the fall of 2015 following the incident of Mr. Lopez Sanchez. And the Board of Supervisors resoundingly rejected attempts to roll back sanctuary. Malia Cohen, a supervisor in District 10, said that she's not going to let Fox News dictate the policies, the historic policies of the city. It was an amazing statement. And I think that shows the power of the organizing of the immigrant communities. I've been a part of this movement for quite a while. And I think, you know, we talk about civil rights. Moments like these are how we define our country and our city and what we believe in. And we either have civil rights or we don't. And I think that San Francisco made a really strong statement to the world, to the public, to the country, that immigration is not what caused what happened on July 1st, that immigrants don't cause crime because they're immigrants, that we have due process in the city, and that we're going to fight to protect the rights of immigrants, just like we're going to fight to protect the rights of all people in the city. And there's always going to be a struggle. There are always going to be people trying to take those rights away. And if we ever rest on our laurels, there will be rollback of civil rights. But in San Francisco right now, I think we're winning the debate. So I feel that as long as we live in a world where there's such a continuity of experience between people who live in Central America and people who live in the United States, I just have hope that we'll continue to promote these policies. And have, I mean, this is just a sanctuary policy. We're not even talking about, you know, the laws that allow people to adjust status, to become residents, to become, you know, lawful members of the community. But yeah, I think that we're going to fight and we can win.
Francisco Ugarte is an immigration attorney at the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. He's working on the case of Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. We often talk about immigrants in this country, but what about their children who've grown up here? Our next story focuses on second-generation Korean Americans that are keeping up the artistic tradition of Korean drumming. The practice dates back hundreds of years, and it's still an integral part of culture today. In 2012, a local group of musicians formed a traditional drumming group that's been playing all over the Bay Area ever since. Reporter Alyssa Jung Perry has the story of how these young Korean Americans are connecting with an ancient heritage in modern times.
This fall, about a dozen drummers calling themselves Eamsay gathered at a farm at UC Santa Cruz to perform and practice. Their beats echoed through the redwoods and fields of the campus. Korean drumming is also known as pungmul. It's a rural tradition that is centuries old. John Lee is a professor of sociology at UC Berkeley. He says the origins of pungmul started with farmers and peasants.
But it got picked up by leftist students who were engaged in student anti-government movement in 1970s and especially 1980s.
Currently, there are over 1.5 million Korean immigrants living in the U.S. Over 20,000 live in the Bay Area. And on every Sunday, group members meet to play the instruments of their ancestors. But Eamsay is not just any group. It's made up of second-generation Koreans who deviate from the norm.
I identify as a queer and trans Korean American.
That's Eugene Kong.
But ever since I can remember, I've always identified as male. I think that feeling different definitely felt alienating in the Korean community. I feel like the Korean community I had exposure to was through the church. Feeling like people at church might make mention like, oh, reading me as male and being like, oh, your name. Oh, actually, you know, oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were a boy. Or, you know, like, oh, you know, you would look so pretty in dresses or something like that. I think as I got older, I didn't feel like I shared the same values and I didn't feel quite as connected.
So most Korean Americans grew up in ethnic Korean households in which parents had brought with them to the U.S. the culture of South Korea in 1960s, 70s, and 80s.
Cal professor John Lee again.
And though, of course, there's a great deal of variation, it is probably fair to say that almost all of them were very conservative. They had a very strict notion of what it meant to be Korean. Heteronormative, that is to say, that very idea of being lesbian, gay, transsexual, transgendered, was simply out of the question.
Many of the members identify as mixed race, queer, or transgender.
We all kind of have each other. Like, we've created a Korean community, and we've all, for one reason or another, have felt alienated from Korean community, or like we didn't belong or felt other, and so we got to really find that with each other, and we're building that and growing that together. Well, I think what I've learned now is that being Korean is self-defined by the person, and there's not a definition of being Korean. That's for you to define for yourself.
For the Eamsay members, the drumming group remains a way to connect with one another and express their own Korean identity. For Cross Currents, I'm Alyssa Jung Perry.
Alyssa Jung Perry is a student at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. love to hear from you. Do you have cultural traditions that you're still practicing today? Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. And to catch up on past episodes of Cross Currents, go online and subscribe to our podcast. Find more at kalw.org/subscribe. Our team includes Geraldine Asu, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Tammy Drummond, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, James Rollins, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liz Mack. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by San Francisco band Sugar Ponies. Suzanne Kramer, the vocalist here, is the songwriter in residence every Tuesday this month at the Bazaar Cafe in San Francisco. Music starts at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Hey, cowboy, you're the bomb. You're the bomb. You gotta go in.